You're listening to WHUS Stores. The views presented in this program may not reflect the views of the University of Connecticut, WHUS Radio, or the staff of the station. Some content may not be suitable for all audiences. Welcome back to Edge of Empathy. This episode will conclude the three-part series on the death penalty. We've covered how working with death row inmates has affected journalists and wardens. Journalists stand at a distance and observe. Wardens are directly involved with the execution process. I've learned a lot from these interviews, but I'm still perplexed. I talk about empathy, but looking at what some of these inmates have done, it can be hard to look over. If someone does something to me, I want to enact revenge. Adrenaline and endorphins pump through me as I upload karmic law in the universe. An eye for an eye and the world goes blind. It's true, isn't it? The only emotions I feel after getting back at somebody are regret, sadness, and anger at myself for not having the decency to stop and say, no, two wrongs don't make a right. I like to joke that a negative multiplied by a negative is positive, but I don't think that morals stand up to math.
Okay, my name is Earl Smith. I was the Protestant chaplain at San Quentin for 24 years. Currently retired. I am the chaplain for the San Francisco 49ers and Golden State Warriors. And I still direct a prison ministry program where we actually have a transition house for men coming out of prison. We have 16 men in a home now. In fact, one of them was on death row and he's living in our home now. So he had his case overturned and he's living with us now. He's been there with us for about 9 months.
Reverend Earl Smith has been ministering to death row inmates for 24 years. He mentions somewhere in the interview that he's not there for just one particular denomination. He's there as a guiding presence to all inmates, regardless of what faith group they're in. We have a lot of layers to unpack. How can anybody forgive these inmates? Reverend Earl Smith mentioned multiple times that there are a lot of layers to ministering. So, let's splash some color on the black and white world of the prison system and ask how to forgive. Layer one, your surroundings.
My job was to also understand that I needed to be able to be available for the staff. I mean, there was an execution team. As part of that execution team, I became present for them. When they each had to be strapped into the chair to understand the process of being strapped in, I got strapped in as well with the chamber closed so that I could understand completely what the inmate was going to feel, how that process worked. But I also did it so that I could understand what the staff who was doing this was going through in that process. As I was able to look at them in their eye, see what they were going through, have conversation with them away from the chamber.
If forgiveness is a holistic process, then I have to be holistic in my approach. The Reverend doesn't just minister to the inmate, but he indirectly ministers to the execution team. He has to understand what the staff were going through in that process. We looked at some of that in our warden episode, where the wardens practice the execution over and over and over again. You have to be familiar with the process to be good at your job. Like, for example, placing himself in the inmate's shoes allows him to feel what that's like, you know, come time the execution, right before the lethal injection takes place. There are also other people in the chamber processing their emotions, the doctor, the warden, etc. Layer two, the inmate. To the chaplain, every inmate is a clean slate.
I believe that as a chaplain, you should not be so much interested in the crime, because the crime could allow you and rob you of your person and the person that needs to minister to that person. What you have to do is to be a presence, irregardless of the crime. I tell people all the time, there's no birth certificate that says murder, rapist, robber, drug dealer, or anything else. So when you get a title of a person in prison, they say, well, that's Earl Smith. He's the murderer. Well, go get my birth certificate, because it doesn't say that. It may say Earl Smith.
Like the warden Grant Culliver said in the previous episode, not reviewing the file of the inmate is just one step to preventing dehumanization. No matter what crimes anybody has committed, it does help to put down the microscope and look at the bigger picture. People are more than
coming
what they
from the background that I came from of a gang membership, drug dealer, whatever. My background is maybe a little different than someone that just went to seminary and got all these levels of degrees. I probably have more street level degrees than I have in a seminary setting. So maybe there's a different level to what I look at also, because sometimes when I would look at people, I realize that easily could be me that I'm ministering to. I have a friend that's one of my closest friends in life. He's doing life without because he killed a police officer. And when we were kids, we used to watch these Jimmy Cagney movies. And he was always the priest that was coming to see me, the inmate that was getting ready to be executed. And that was how we processed that was our little game that we would play. And after I'd been in San Quentin a while, he ended up there where I had to go to his cell. So the roles were reversed. And I remember the first time going to his cell and seeing the role reverse, and him and I remembering as kids what we used to do, and we broke down crying because, and those things linger, those things stick with you when you have moments with inmates, no matter what they've done.
Reverend Earl Smith comes to know these inmates more intimately than any of us could imagine. He spends hours and hours with these people writing letters to their families and sometimes being the only pathway to the outside world. When your expiration date is looming, some pretty intimate conversations can take place. And the Reverend is correct. If you grow up in the environments that the inmates did, it's easier to relate on some level to how they turned out that way. You're not defined by your mistakes. I think we're getting somewhere. Something interesting popped up during our discussion. It's about the role of the chaplain in the inmate's life.
So for me, I have to figure out how can I make you present in the moment to clearly understand what you've done, the implications of what you've done now is that they're saying you're going to be executed. And the reality is after execution, what happens? That's my job.
And then kind of jumping off of that, you said earlier, you're there to help the inmate find peace, right? I don't want to twist words.
I mean, they may have, the reality is, Jonathan, that an inmate may have peace with the fact that he committed murder. So I can't help him have peace if he's already had it. He may have found peace at the moment of that incident, at the incident offense that caused him to be on death row or in prison. So I'm not there to, what I'm there to, shalom is a greeting of hello as well as goodbye, right?
So it's not necessarily about being a sort of savior or peacemaker from the inmate, but a bridge between this world and whatever comes next. Coming back to empathizing and forgiveness for death row inmates, it's still hard for me to look past the crimes. The Reverend even discusses how seeing some of what the prisoners have done to children or other people have made him pause. He doesn't leave the stories behind at the prison. Seeing media related to executions and crimes like in the newspaper makes him think of some of his own cases. Layer 3, the family.
I walked some young people around who were there to witness the execution of a person who had killed their father. And I walked them around. One of the things that I saw a need to do was to spend time with the victim's family members because they're victims as well. So I started a process on execution nights. I would go to where they were being sort of grouped together, and I'd get them and I sort of walk them around the prison and just talk to them because I wanted to know more about them. And I wanted to know more about what would this process do for them. in this particular case, I remember them asking me about what it was going to look like. What would it feel? What, you know, what are they going to see? And I explained the best I could. And when it was done, the young girl says, she looks at me and says, "Is that it?" I said, "Well," she says, "it just looks like he went to sleep." Now, that's not what she was expecting, because she was expecting some horrific pain to be associated, because she had carried pain as a result of her father dying, being killed. And for her to see that was the end result, there was almost like there was an unease and unease associated with the fact that that was it, that it was over, that person had died.
There was a University of Minnesota study conducted by Scott Vallum and a few other co-authors. He tried to find statements from co-victims, which are families and survivors of the crimes. Out of the 159 statements, 65 of them, or 41%, said that it brought some form of closure and healing. 36 said that they were glad it came to a conclusion. 27 said they found peace and relief. However, only 4, or 2.5%, found true closure. It's hard to extrapolate this to the entire population of co-victims, but I still think it holds merit. If the death penalty and the pain inflicted doesn't bring true closure to most, what are we supposed to do?
Because after the execution, you now have added another layer to what you've gone through. Because not only have you lost a family member, but you witnessed someone die right before your eyes. And you may have joy, or you may have peace, or there may be sorrow, but you may also wonder, now what?
The family members on top of the crime have to process the death. It's just layer after layer after layer of suffering. When does it end? What are they supposed to do?
Right, and I had another guy that, the first guy I executed was Robert Alton Harris. He was executed through the gas chamber. After his execution, before he asked me to go ask one of the victims' families if they would forgive him. And the lady told me, tell him I said no. So I went back, sat in front of him. We played a game of chess and I was telling him, she said no. He was very, he was not asking, will you forgive me so I cannot get executed? He was asking because he was saying, I was wrong, and I at least need to know that you can acknowledge that I'm telling you I was wrong. The end results, after they said he was dead, I went into the room where all the official visitors was, and as I walked in, she ran up and grabbed me in a bear hug and was choking me, and she was screaming, did you tell him I forgave him? Did you tell him I forgave him? And I remember taking her arms off of my neck, and I said, you told me to tell him no. What's her last memory?
Asking for forgiveness from the family is infinitely harder than receiving forgiveness from me. It's also a struggle for the family to forgive or let go. My spouse, my kid, whatever, wasn't the one affected. Are we under obligation to forgive? And can we really request such a thing from families? Can the family really ask those close to themselves and to other victims to forgive such a heinous crime? I don't know. And honestly, I don't think so. God forbid my family was killed and I have to suffer like rage and trauma and just a lifetime of struggle that would take to like overcome. It's not fair to them. It's not fair. And the world isn't fair. But thinking with hate and anger isn't going to help.
So I had one lady that worked with me at the 49ers, and her son, Jeff, was a police officer, and a guy killed him. And she was just, you know, she was adamant that she wanted to get the death penalty, and she couldn't wait till he got. And I told her, I said, you know, if you really want to move on and not be held hostage by what this crime he did to your son, horrific crime, I said, the way you move on is you let him get life without, and you can move on because you never have to deal with that guy again. You won't have to get the letters from the court. You won't have to go to court when he's going to court for reviews. And you won't move on because she's gonna always miss her son, Jeff. police officer. This guy kills him. I mean, think about that. He's there to serve and protect. He's a citizen, and he's protecting the citizens of this country in our area, and this guy kills him. She's hurt because she's proud that her son had made it to this level, that he was a police officer. And then their son is, then he dies. But what I told her was, don't allow the death penalty to hold you hostage. She was able to accept that finally. And that guy is now, he's still, if he is alive, she doesn't know. She knows what prison he's in. If he's, because that's the only prison he could be in for the rest of his life. But she doesn't have to get notified about any of that. So that's a different layer to the whole process.
Don't let the death penalty hold you hostage. It could take a lifetime to get to that point, but I think the path to forgiveness, no matter how many obstacles it's wrought with, is the path worth taking. I don't want to sound like I'm completely forgiving these inmates for what they have done. I'm merely suggesting and discovering for myself that empathy can be a long way to healing and recovering from trauma. Why should we forgive? How can I forgive? And how can we even begin to forgive? 1. Look beyond the circumstances and the crime. A person is a product of their past. Hate and anger are reasonable responses to cruel and unusual crimes. People are under no obligation to forgive. And 3, forgiving and letting go are really hard. It takes a lifetime to forget and let go of things. It takes practice. And it's hardest for those who have suffered irreparable trauma. It's hardest to do that with people like death row inmates. And that's why they're on the edge of empathy. Thank you to Edoy, Podington Bear, Welcome Wizard, The Lovely Moon, Jazar, and Kai Engel for the wonderful music. You can find them at Free Music Archive. Thank you to Grace, Zach, Kate, and Jason for keeping me on track and providing me with feedback on my script and music choices and podcast editing. They're wonderful people. I couldn't have done this without them. Not sure where else this podcast will take me. I'm sure it'll be just as interesting as this one. I have a whole list of topics I plan to do. But until then, I hope you have a great week, weekend, semester, if you're not a college student, a better year. And I'll see you next time. Bye. You're listening to WHUS Stores.